Our first speaker today is Bea Kantasch, who is a postdoctoral researcher and lecturer at the University of Kassel in Germany. And he's coming from a background in psychology, and he's working on an interdisciplinary project on assistance dogs. So over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Erika, for organizing this wonderful event. Thank you for being here. And thanks to all the people who made this event possible, you know, IT workers, caterers who brought food, cleaners, and all this invisible care work behind that event, actually. So today I would like to talk about assistant dogs as caregivers, because, you know, in our discussion, care is mostly something that humans do, like animals are on the receiving end of the care. So how, for instance, we can think dogs as caregivers, because most of the time they do work. I mean, some of them can be done by people, but some tasks they do actually requires their senses, like no human can do the work that they do. And also I would like to talk a little bit about dog breeds, and maybe in the discussion we can talk about a general discussion about breed as a disability issue, because there is this violence behind histories of breeds. And actually, if you think about dogs, I don't know, the classifications differ, but there are 300, maybe more, different types of dog breeds, which is very interesting. You know, the pandemic made it like visible how care work is still very much gendered, racialized. So I think it's also interesting to think care in this intersectional perspective. And still, you know, it's done by women, for instance, but also animals, the invisible work of animals. You know, some people argue that actually it is the surplus value that we got from animals that produced actually capitalist relations. So it's not only the invisibilized labors of women, for instance, but also animals. Horses and dogs play an important role, I think. And I think care in this context, intersectional, but also how care is commodified and quantified, reflecting on that can open new forms of critique, new you know, way of intersectional thought, community building, and also maybe policy making. And also a few years ago, I organized a conference actually at the ICI Berlin, where I was doing my postdoctoral research, a project about disability and time. And we, like, the title of the conference was Why Care? And we invited a speaker from the UK, Lisa Baretzer, who is a psychosocial in the Department of Psychosocial Studies in Birkbeck, University of London. And I found her way of theorizing care interesting. It is embedded in feminist theory, you know, turning like matters into care and how we relate to them, how we affect, and in turn how we are affected by our relation. And actually also in that conference we realized that care, you know, is a site of like connection, help, mutual responsibility, but it also has this darker side we were mentioning yesterday, like dispossession, you know, horrible things have been done under care. And it can be, you know, willful, but also unintended things that are done within care. And also I have a cultural studies perspective, you know, instead of saying like what care is, I find it more interesting to look at what care does and putting it into practice. I was also writing my PhD thesis on hope, and I was really struggling, like, what hope is, but then I realized that it is more interesting to look at sites which are promoted as hopeful, or what hope does, how hope is attached to certain situations, people, etc. And hope also, I thought, oh, it's going to be, you know, a hopeful project, but hope also has a darker side, because most of the time we hope when we are in a desperate situation, or hope entails this aspect of fear and care. I think also it's, I think the etymology of care has to do with like worry, even like deathbed. So it's not really all these, you know, positive things or love and responsibility we associate with care. And Lisa Baretzer actually puts hope into this temporal perspective, and her main argument is that caring takes time. and she defines care in terms of this arduous temporal practice of maintaining ongoing relations with others and the world. And also, you know, within feminist care ethics, it's mostly about care is everything we do to maintain and repair our world. So it's this practicing of care, I think is important to reflect on. And you know, in that book, Lisa Beretzer like delivers an account of non-productive and non-developmentalist forms of time, which is about staying, maintaining, repeating, delaying, enduring, recalling, and remaining. All relates to care. And when I think about assistant dogs, you know, the training that they have to go, for instance, they also do all these sometimes seemingly non-productive or non-developmentalist tasks. They have to stay, they have to maintain a certain behavior. There's a lot of repetition, there is a lot of delay, a lot of endurance, and a lot of remaining in certain positions. So assistant dogs are purpose-bred canines individually trained to help people with disabilities. The idea is that they mitigate disability-related issues. The most known example is guide dogs, helping blind people or people with visual impairments, hearing dogs, mobility assistant dogs, providing balance or stability, so a person, for instance, can hold on to dog and stand up. Medical alert or seizure dogs, because of their sense of smell, they can actually smell hormonal changes in your body, and sometimes they can bring your medication, for instance, for diabetic people, or if somebody has seizure, for instance, the dog can help comfort them, make sure that there is no, you know, risk around the area. Sometimes they learn to like this deep pressure, you know, they put their paws. So and the functions are always like changing. Psychiatric service dogs, that was the first time I met an assistant dog actually. I was in a conference and there was this labradoodle puppy and I wanted to pet the puppy and they said, it's working. And I didn't really understand how that little puppy, like 4 months old, 4 weeks old, sorry, is working. And the person got that from a health insurance in the Netherlands. So they were giving to help against anxiety, you know, depression and this kind of things. But they are not emotional, they are different from emotional support dogs, because emotional support dog can be any dog. They don't have to have this formal training, but assistant dogs have to have this formal training and from this, you know, accredited institutions also. And now, you know, there are medical detection or biodetection dogs. Dogs can even sniff out malaria or COVID, for instance. The idea is that you put this, also known as sniffer dogs, to airports, so they sniff out people who, and then you test only these people. And already it's tested in Norway, in some countries, also in Germany they are being trained. And the first assistance dog school was founded in Germany, in Oldenburg, in 1919, I think. After the First World War, you know, many people came blind, like war veterans, because they were using like this, you know, mustard gas and things like that. And then the second one, the first one was closed. In 4 years, they opened the second one in Potsdam, close to Berlin. And they were mostly using German Shepherd dog. And you know, this type of breed is also associated with national unity in Germany, you know, also with the Nazi period. And you know, sometimes it's also interesting to put this dog breed into wider context of nationalism, for instance, or eugenics, and in this context, for instance, disability. And of course there is sexuality, you know, artificial insemination. So, and it's amazing like how dogs reflect all these anxieties that we humans project on them. And you know, there was this Swiss person training military dogs, heard about this school, went to Germany. She was actually based in the USA, then she went back to USA, wrote a piece about that, and then some people read about it, and the first assistant dog school also emerged in the USA following this in early 20s. But this is, you know, the first school, there are like some people are arguing that blind, like dogs were guiding blind people in ancient Egypt, for instance, that there are some inscriptions, but this is the first modern dog school. Also, you know, during that time in 1920s, between this war period, this is like an emergency money in Germany, and it says like German guide dog for war blind. So they were trying to promote public awareness. But after 100 years, they are still doing this public awareness because there is still a lot of confusion about like assistant dogs, which are known as service dogs in the USA. Then, you know, emotional support dog, facility dog, therapy dog. So there is all this confusion, but assistant dogs can enter into places, public spaces, which are denied to companion animals. In the USA, for instance, you can only ask two people because dogs don't have to be don't have to have an ID. So you can only ask, is this a trained dog, and which tasks the dog can do. In Germany, because of the state system, there is also not a standardized approach, for instance. So sometimes it depends from airlines to airlines, or you know, in housing there are different laws. So there is no like consensus about the accessibility of dogs in public spaces. And you know, my I visited an assistant dog school in Zagreb in Belgium. During COVID, I had interview with people in also Belgium, the USA. So, you know, there is this idea that dogs actually love their work. They love to please humans. They are born for this work. And in Zagreb, for instance, they are only, it's called Silver Center, Rehabilitation Center. They are only using Labradors. Even though the first breed was the German Shepherd dogs, they, because the dogs first, like they have this 1.5 years of training period. And at the beginning, there is this foster families taking the dogs and bringing them to the assistant schools like twice a month or something like that, because the dog has to learn, you know, spending time with people, their smell, you know, socialization is very important. But in this school, for instance, it's only Labradors. They are born in that center. They have all these ethical breeding programs where dogs you know, get certain numbers about like their breedability, if that's a word. And I'm also curious, like, why Labradors? Why, like, Labradors and Golden Retrievers are the most commonly used type of dogs, also German Shepherd dogs. There are, of course, organizations using only rescue dogs, but overall, in my research, I realized that in the United States, in Europe and in Australia, for instance, it's mostly Labradors are used as assistant dogs because they say, you know, German Shepherd dogs are very attached to their first human companion, and it's very difficult to, you know, find them another guardian. And but then at this organization, for instance, they were saying that it's very easy to train Labradors, give them food, and they will do anything. And it's really also a lot of food, like a lot of treats. Here you see, you know, these are like, I think 5-6 weeks old. The next day they were having their vaccinations, and it's constantly, they're expecting, you know, food all the time because, you know, you already start training them, like sitting in a certain position. And you know, there's all these ideas about obedience, docility, and utility that is embedded in, especially in Labradors. And recently, I'm also interested in autism assistant dogs. This is also an emerging subcategory of assistant dogs. So the idea is that you train dogs especially to mitigate autism-related impairments. which is about, you know, social interaction, I don't know, dealing with like meltdowns or shutdowns or this eloping, you know, autistic children like run away, some organizations actually tethering the dog to the child, but then it's actually the parents are guiding the dog. So the dog is caring for the child, the parent is caring for the child is caring for the dog, so there is this web of caring relations here. And both dog training and child education, I see similarities. We want both of them to be obedient, to show normal behavior, show no anxiety, no stress, so, and you know, both in dog training and autism intervention, they are using the theories of B.F. Skinner, his positive reinforcement. The assistant dog schools are really proud that they are not using any aversive techniques, but only positive reinforcement. But during my visit, I saw so many times in which, you know, if a dog is not sitting in a position, they are just, you know, using like force, for instance. So it's not only positive reinforcement, but physical correction is also a part of it. And of course, you know, there are all these types of dogs, all these different categorizations, and then we only select some of them. And for me, this is also, you know, a disability issue, because the common idea is that dogs love to help people, or they are born for this task, they have these innate capacities. But we forget that it's actually has these histories of hundreds of years of domestication, selective breeding, and the selective breeding also involves this culling dogs that actually are not obedient enough, they don't fit into this narrative. Sonora Taylor's book actually also made me think about how animality and disability interact, how speciesism and ableism are kind of, you know, co-constituting each other. We are not really adding one to the other, but like speciesism and this ableism or ableism actually are very much intersected. So Taylor is arguing that we need to creep animal ethics, incorporating a disability politics into the ways we think about animals. It is essential that we examine the shared systems and ideologies that oppress both disabled humans and non-human animals, because ableism perpetuates animal oppression in more areas than the linguistic. Indeed, ableism is intimately entangled with speciesism and is deeply relevant to thinking through the ways non-human animals are judged, categorized, and exploited. And CRIP is like queer, you know, more political, going beyond this binary opposition between ability and disability, more to the face and showing like contesting ableism to be more inclusive also. And, you know, it's like queer, you can use it as a verb also, as an adjective, as a noun. It comes from the word cripple, you know, reclaiming that hurtful word and building a politics around it. And you know, when I use terms like disabled, people with disabilities, CRIP, I switch because there is no consensus. Some people argue a person first language, person with a disability, because people with disabilities historically have been denied agency and humanization. Or you know, in autism community, for instance, some people refer being referred as autistic because they want their identity to be acknowledged. So I was thinking, like, in this light, how I can care, or how do I care for dogs? First of all, I think we really need to change this perspective about relating dogs only in terms of their breed, because this is very calculated, very much about utility. The first question when you see a dog, what type of dog is that? So I wonder what kind of violence or what kind of, you know, this idea of caring for dogs eliminates other ways of relating. Yeah, this is kind of the same. But because the situation is so mixed up at the moment, and because there are all these breed-specific disabilities, you know, dachshunds, the sausage dogs, have always back problems. Golden retrievers have cancer, for instance. The French bulldog, because of the increased skull size, sometimes cannot give birth, so we have to have C-section. So there is, on this part, going beyond thinking about breed standards, but because of the complexity of the situations, we cannot really eliminate, because we have to know about this breed-specific situation. So care and uncaring in dog breeding is a very interesting issue. And the last thing I want to say about neurodiversity and thinking diversity, you know, we also in disability or in animals, we want predictable, normal, obedient behavior. But what about, for instance, dogs which are neurodiverse? What about dogs which are not good dogs? Because we always say, good dog, you do something that I want you to do. So maybe bring this neurodiversity perspective to animal research could be interesting. And, you know, finally, breed and race, you know, how actually the term normal and dog shows emerge at the same time in 1840s and 50s, norm as, you know, pertaining to an ideal, for instance, how breed and queer theory, how breed and this trainability of populations and race, how breed and disability affect each other. Thank you very much.
Final speaker who has waited patiently to give her talk, I'm just finding my right bit of paper here, is, no, that's the wrong bit of paper, Natalia Czeska. I got one right. Natalia Czeska Holmes, who's a PhD student in sociology at the University of Adelaide in Australia and the University of Nottingham in the UK, and that's an easy journey right there.
Commutable.
And she is combining interests in animal-human relations, food ethics, environmental politics, and alternative food ways.
Thank you. Thanks for waiting so long, and I hope that everyone's going to fall asleep during the final talk. Thank you so much again, Erica, and all the organisers. This is my first in-person conference as part of my PhD, so I'm slightly terrified, but also it's a really nice space to be in as well. I'm going to take you a little bit into the world of raw meat-based diets and companion dogs. And I've really been sort of just exploring this quite conceptually, and I've got empirical work coming up, but unfortunately no data to present to you yet. So really I'm just here to pick your brains and ask you to help me sort of like think through a couple of the issues that I've also been thinking about while thinking about raw feeding. So I've got two parts really to this presentation, and the first is just taking you into this world of raw meat-based diets for dogs. Just on terminology, I might say raw meat-based diets or raw feeding kind of interchangeably. And to do this, I'll draw on shifting human and companion animal relations and more broadly alternative diets, and give you a bit of a background to what raw feeding is. And I put there a bit of a trigger warning, so there are a couple of images of raw meat, it's just to illustrate what these diets actually consist of. But I personally, as a vegan, sometimes find them a little bit overwhelming. And then the second part goes into the case for care that I'm trying to argue for. And I've looked at this in terms of different aspects of raw feeding, or different aspects of care involved in raw feeding. And then finally, I will just very briefly talk about my fieldwork that I'm going to be doing both here in the UK and in Australia. So the world of raw meat-based diets. So I started thinking about this in terms of shifting human and companion animal relations. And in recent years, we've seen the increasing humanization of companion dogs. And this has involved a shift in attitudes towards them being seen more as family members or kin. In the UK, there are around 12.5 million dogs that are kept as pets in British homes, and this was as of 2021. So this is post-COVID statistics. There was quite a big increase actually during COVID. And simultaneously, what we're seeing is the commercialization of the companion animal industry. As of 2020, it was globally worth $232 billion, which I find quite staggering. And the most dominant portion of this market is pet food. So in 2021, £3.2 billion was spent on pet food. And sort of upon this backdrop, what I've been thinking about for the last year and a half of my PhD, which seems like a long time to be thinking about something, but yeah, the increasing popularity of alternative diets. I'm not really sure yet, or I guess one of the questions that I'm kind of asking is, where does this all fit within this framework behind me? And I'm trying to probe this really. And so there's multiple different variations of alternative diets, but broadly you could look at raw meat-based diets, and then on the other end of the spectrum, sort of vegetarian and vegan diets for dogs. I can talk more about why I've specifically focused on raw meat-based diets and why not vegetarian vegan diets, and would be happy to discuss that a little bit later as well. But firstly, I want to take you into the world of raw feeding if you're not that familiar with it. So it could be sort of like officially defined, but there is a common definition that these are commercial and homemade diets for companion animals that include uncooked meat ingredients from farmed or wild animals. So on the right hand side, I've tried to sort of just display, you've got the commercial variation on the left hand side and then the more homemade variation on the right hand side. And there are it's a whole world that I've tried to sort of dive into and make sense of. But originally, they were sort of more originated as homemade diets and increasingly have become more commercialized over time. And they're often marketed as sort of natural, human grade, and I find this word so puzzling, but we can talk about that more, healthy and even ethical alternatives to conventional kibble diets. So traditionally, well, not even traditionally, but since the commercialization of the companion animal industry and the pet food industry in particular around 1950s, especially, the majority of dogs have been fed conventional kibble diets. And increasingly, this is sort of shifting, and I think that's quite interesting in terms of what dogs are being fed. So globally, 66% of guardians include raw meat in their dogs' diets. And this was according to a study by Sarah Dodd and colleagues in 2020. And what I found really fascinating, so 11% of guardians in this study sample, I think it was of over 3,000 people, but globally, feed raw exclusively in the UK. And I just had no idea at the time. In Australia, it's higher. I think it's 16% feed raw exclusively. So I'm looking at that a bit as well. And there are, as I said before, sort of different feeding models. So there's not just one raw meat-based diet ideology, but depending on constructions of dogs as either omnivores or carnivores, there's kind of different ratios of either what meats, whether you include vegetables, and it's just a whole political world that I would love to dive into, and it's been great to listen to the historians as well. So that's, yeah, another project for another time. So in order to demonstrate or really make the case for why I think care is important, I want to open up raw feeding by showing you what, first of all, is actually known or what has been researched so far. So almost all of the studies that look at raw feeding have been conducted from a nutrition or animal science perspective. You'll probably have seen in the media it's quite a controversial topic, especially among veterinarians, and especially the vets that I've spoken to just hate it. So I've also, again, another project. But what is known so far about raw feeders is that they are really concerned about their pet's health, and that's one of the key motivations for why someone might feed this diet. Interestingly, also, they place less trust in commercial pet food. So again, it's kind of challenging potentially this commercialization mantra. And additionally, and this is something I really want to explore more if we look on the right-hand side, is people are driven by this idea that this is a natural diet. And what we don't know is this natural in terms of the sort of whole foods and healthy foods, or is this natural based on the idea of a dog being carnivorous due to its ancestry with wolves? And I'll talk about this a little bit more later on. And finally, at the bottom, so raw feeders also place less trust in vets and are turning more towards online sources of information. So I spend a lot of my time in Facebook groups. It's just fascinating, like going through, and some of them, to join the group, you're not allowed to vet bash, which is one of the terms. So people often go, there have been posts where people are just saying that their vets hate raw feeding, so they hate vets, and it's all become this whole thing. So yeah, that's, if anyone has some time, that's a world that's definitely worth going into. And what I have been thinking about is how to open this topic up. I think that there has been sort of narrow focus here that overlooks constructions of responsibility and care around raw feeding. Simultaneously, the quantitative nature of these studies, they lack depth in the sense of understanding identities and constructions of identities, particularly in relation to these concepts of naturalness and dogs as carnivores, which I find really fascinating. And finally, there's an absence of relational approaches. So what I'm also drawn to, and this is based on previous work that I've done around food politics, is sort of the tensions and conflicts regarding food choice, so why you might choose this and how this might relate to your own diet. And that's something that's not really looked at in terms of what the dog guardian eats themselves and what they then feed their dogs. So these were all kind of questions that I was trying to expand and move, I guess, like move raw feeding into a slightly different area from a more social science perspective. So my second part of the presentation is then about the case for care and why I think care is relevant for this topic. So I then spent a while sort of like diving into literature on human and canine relations. And what's really clear is that care is important. There's papers that talk about the changing conceptions of care in canine-human relations, and this is also expressed in language, where there's been a shift from talking about companion animals as pets to this, well, I'm using the term myself, companion animals. Again, there's different politics around that that we could also discuss later. And simultaneously, the shift from owners to caretakers or guardians. What I've been trying to sort of like make this link between food and care and where I think this all stems from. And I really think that food is the bedrock of the caring relation between humans and dogs due to the dependency of dogs on humans, or companion dogs and domestic dogs on humans for food, and the responsibility that guardians have to provide food for their dogs. And this is enshrined in law in the UK under the Animal Welfare Act of 2006, where there's this quite vague terminology, but owners or guardians have a duty of care to ensure a suitable diet. And that is kind of where this all starts to unravel, because what does that mean? And that's part of the debate and discussion that's been going on. So rather than define care, I've been thinking about different aspects of care that I could explore in relation to dog feeding more generally and raw feeding more specifically. I'm not sure that these are separate yet, and I think some of the discussions that we've had have shown that they're probably not, but I'm going to present them as I have them. So first of all, I'm going to look at constructions of identity. So on the one hand, the humanization of companion dogs, and on the other, constructions of difference in relation to food and what they should be fed. I then am going to talk a bit more about inclusion, so relational perspectives that involve more than human families. And then something that's just been niggling at me the whole time is, what about food? What about food animals? And it's just not in the literature. So that's kind of what I'm trying to contribute to here, I guess, is just really open this topic up and talk about exclusions. And I think sort of different papers have also talked about this as well. So first of all, in terms of dogs' identity, I previously mentioned we've seen this sort of humanization of pet keeping. And this is where sort of anthropomorphic constructions of care have been applied to dogs, where they're ascribed human-like characteristics, and quite often dogs will be referred to as child substitutes, or I don't know if you've heard the term fur babies, I find also quite an interesting one. And then when we link this with commercialization, what we've seen is a growth in the premium pet and healthy pet food markets. And what I have over here, this isn't an example of a raw diet, but I think quite an interesting one in terms of the humanization of dog food in general. But this is Lily's Kitchen, a company that's just been acquired by Nestle, which is interesting. But cottage pie for dogs. I mean, that's, you know, sort of humanization at its key there. And I found this really interesting, paper by Tim Wall, who writes for a pet food industry magazine. He's trying to push the case for like one food and feeding pets like people. And sometimes when I just read, I don't know, I'm just trying to unpack that a little bit. But yeah, so one of my sort of critiques of this perspective, as there have been hundreds of critiques of the humanization hypothesis, is about the ascription of a kind of family status to an animal based on its similarness to humans, and not recognizing them for their inherent values and differences. And at the same time, it doesn't recognize other kinds of relations that might exist between humans and dogs. On the other side, I've been thinking a lot about difference in relation to raw feeding in particular. So quite often, constructions of raw feeding draw on dogs' ancestries with wolves, however flawed that might be, but really kind of essentialize these natural and instinctual behaviors. I think I was speaking to Kim before. I have a friend who is a vegan and feeds their dog a raw meat-based diet. And when I asked her why, she was like, well, he's a wolf. And I was like, well, okay, that's a whole conversation, but okay. So that actually was one of the motivations of why I'm doing this project, because I just found that fascinating. And I'll talk more about the vegan, where that comes in later. But yeah, at the same time then with this anti-commercialization, I'm not sure yet to what extent raw feeding is a challenge against the commercialization of pet food, but that's sort of also what I'm trying to look at. But there is this idea of sort of alternative companionship. So how are we creating new and alternative diets that also might construct animals as natural? And I just, there's a example here from Aquila, which is a raw pet food company, and I don't know if you can see it very well, but there's a wolf there, and there's actually a quote from the Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling about wolves on the packaging. I mean, this is not representative, it's quite an extreme example, but very much, and it reminded me of what you said, Ginny, before about constructions of domestic and wild animals, and this is very much going into the wild. Again, my critique of this construction of dogs' identity based on difference, it's again framing humans as other from, or animals as other from human, and I think further bifurcating this divide between the human and the animal based on essentializing behaviors rather than looking at relational aspects. So I've been thinking a bit more in the sort of second aspect of my little list about relationality and interspecies care. And so authors such as Charles and Davis have talked about kinship, where they foregrounded these narratives of entanglement and relations between humans and dogs that also shift conceptions of the family itself. So not saying that dogs need to be like children to become family members, but what does it mean to have a more than human family? And Haraway, of course, was very helpful in talking about co-constitutive relationships and how neither of the partners precede their relating. There's also a really fascinating paper by Julianne Smith about house rabbits, where she talks about performance ethics. And I found this really useful in terms of thinking through, despite the fact that humans and dogs will never be equal, we should still be attentive to opportunities for animal agency and recognize that non-human animals also perform their own natures. So in terms of raw feeding, I'm kind of trying to look for what this might be in this space. And also I found Erica Cudworth's concept of muddy living. We were just having a conversation about sort of like wading through the mud of life, and very philosophical, but yeah, what does it mean to live alongside and with a non-human animal in your home? And she asks, I think this is such a fantastic question, but how might care and conviviality enable the relative flourishing and of humans and animal companions? So again, I'm kind of going into this project looking at what kind of care might be possible, and again by asking what are guardians' understandings of species appropriate care. Okay, now comes my sort of, yeah, critique, not really sure how this all fits in, but I think is important, the food. And the food animals that I think have been overlooked in these constructions of more than human families, 2 minutes, So in Josh Milburn, who's a philosopher, he talks about the animal lovers paradox, where people that presumably animal lovers or who own companion animals, they also commit or they, what's the word? There's acts of suffering that come through their relationships with companion animals in the feeding of meat to their companion animals that hinges upon the death of other non-human animals. Very complicated, I should have really synthesized that better. This has also been expressed sort of through the vegetarian's dilemma. So people that themselves eat a vegetarian diet, what does it mean to feed your dog meat, and how might this conflict with your own ethical values? And again, from Cudworth's work, there was a quote where she did interviews with dog owners where they said, "I'm a vegetarian, but she's a dog." And what does that mean in terms of constructions of diets in multi-species households? And again, to draw on the fantastic Eva Giraud, ethics of exclusion. So how might we be attentive to the entities, the practices and ways of being that are foreclosed when other entangled realities are materialized? So what I've been really thinking about is what are the tensions that might be involved in species appropriate care. And specifically, I'm going to be focusing on vegan and vegetarian dog guardians who feed their dogs raw meat-based diets. So I'm looking at how vegetarian, I should have put, and vegan raw feeders negotiate the boundaries for more than human family members. Yeah, I've got like 30 seconds, I think. so this is kind of my project. I'm about to dive into the empirical work with dog guardians and dogs in the UK and also in Australia. That'll be next year. And I've kind of been trying to construct how I can be attentive to all these different aspects and the relations, not just between the dogs and their guardians, but also bring in the food and look at different aspects in terms of ethics related to what a vegan and vegetarian might feel about food or think about food, and then what they feed their dog. And yeah, sort of these are some of the, I don't really know what these are, some of the aspects that I've been thinking about that come along with this. So just to conclude, I hope I've made the case of why I think care is important for thinking about not only feeding dogs, but especially raw meat-based diets. And I guess my final message is that despite the entanglements that are so important in interspecies care and drawing on some of the kind of the darker sides of care that we've been talking about, what are the animals or which animals are excluded and why? And that's really kind of where this all comes in for me in terms of moving more towards a multi-species ethic of care that might be possible in a more than human family. So I have a couple of questions. We don't have to talk about them at all, but I just thought they might be, yeah. So I've been thinking a bit about caring methods. So if inclusion is the goal, how do I include companion dogs as participants in my research? So any ethical and practical considerations, and also include the food and food animals. So I have sort of ways that I'm planning to do this, but just any insights would be really helpful. Just something that's been, I guess, on my mind for a while is how to work with and think through ambivalence. And there's so much in dog-human relations literature and animal literature more broadly about ambivalent tensions between all these aspects we've been talking about. And while I want to be attentive to the possibilities of non-human animal agency, how do I remain critical at the same time? I sometimes feel like I have two different hats that I put on, and one for one, and how does one kind of, very much entangle them throughout the way that you're thinking about these problems and questions and phenomena? So yeah, that's me. I have some references if anyone's interested. Great, thank you.
Brilliant, thank you. Nick, if you want to come up, we have got time.